We need to focus on the stability and growth of our current portfolio rather than necessarily growing the number of units within our portfolio. So instead of two or three deals, it may only be one. And that's in part because it's become much harder to underwrite deals that make sense.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I am your host, Justin Dixon. And today we've got Tim Little on the podcast. He is the founder and CEO of Zana Investments, based in Tampa, Florida. But we talk about his journey as he started his life kind of after high school, going right into the Army, went to college, went back in the military, and then had a ton of student debt, which he aggressively paid off. And we talk about his journey from paying off debt to starting his real estate investing journey with a duplex, and then kind of moving into the syndication world, first as a passive investor, and then getting into it as a general partner and raising money. And we talk a lot about asset management and how that is very important for the success of any multifamily real estate deal. So very interesting episode. So let's get Tim on the pod. All right, Tim, man, welcome to the podcast. Happy to have you on.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate you having me on here.
No, I'm excited to kind of dig into your story and everything. So why don't we start there? Give everybody a little bit of an overview of kind of who you are, where you are, and what you're up to.
Yeah, so my background is largely military. Joined the Army straight out of high school, literally a month after I graduated high school. I was at basic training and did that for a couple of years until I decided I was finally ready to go to college and got out, went to Florida State for international affairs. And was kind of going on that track for a little bit until one of the ROTC recruiters got to me and was like, hey, you got some, you know, military experience already. What do you think about becoming an officer? And he's like, you'll have a guaranteed job when you graduate college. So I took him up on that offer and got commissioned as an officer when I graduated college. Did that for about 5 years on active duty, and then was ready to take a knee after a couple of combat deployments. And decided to get out and start going to school again. And that's when I started going to grad school, did the poor grad school thing for a while. Didn't really feel like I could invest while I was in grad school because I felt like so many students, right, that I just didn't have any money, even though I did start educating myself, reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad and all that stuff. So I knew I wanted to invest at that point. I just didn't feel like I was in a position to do so until I got my first real job after grad school. And had a little extra income coming in, despite the fact that I had oppressive student loans hanging over my head as well. We could talk about that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the military first and kind of that. Was that something you kind of knew that was your path early on? It sounds like you kind of jumped right from high school into that. Was that, you know, bred in you as far as like, you know, family and friends doing it, or kind of how did that work?
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing. It really wasn't, because I mean, you know, I had a grandfather who was in the Korean War, and my mom was in the Navy for a bit, but there wasn't this expectation from anyone that I joined the military. It wasn't like that. I think I was just in a position where, one, my dad was like, listen, I have zero money to give you for college. So there's that. And I wanted to travel. And it seemed like the Army was the best opportunity to do both of those things while serving my country. So I did get money for college. I got the GI Bill way back then. And I wanted to go to Germany because I had done student foreign exchange when I was in high school. So I actually knew people there. So they sent me to Korea, which makes absolute sense. So, you know, I got some money for school out of it, and I certainly got to travel too. So that was the real reason that I went in. But then, of course, I wouldn't say I fell in love with it, but I certainly appreciated it and learned to like it and kind of found my calling after that. And I've been in the military ever since. I'm still in the Army Reserves. So right now I'm at about 27 years of total service, counting all the different types.
Got it. And then so you get out, go to college, go back in, and then you get out again and I guess get out active duty style. But then you kind of realize, hey, I want to invest. So how did real estate and just general investing kind of pop into your brain as far as like what you wanted to do post-college, post, you know, your military career?
Yeah. And I guess I forgot to mention, while I was in, I was stationed at Colorado Springs for a little bit in Colorado. And I wound up going to one of these conventions that was all about like real estate investing and other random investing opportunities. It was kind of shady, but back then, this was the 2005 timeframe when like everybody was investing in just buying single family homes and making millions of dollars, you know, for no money down. It was just ridiculous. I bought into it a little bit, but I got as far as buying like a course on, you know, driving for dollars and haggling with little old ladies whose husband just died and stuff like that. And I was like, it didn't feel right to me. It just didn't resonate. And then I wound up getting deployed right after that anyways. So that's where timing really comes into play in terms of being ready and in the right mindset and right position to start investing, which is where I found myself, like I said, once I was back in the workforce, as it were, after grad school, I was aggressively paying down my school loans. So I didn't have a ton of extra money, but I kind of went back to that whole rich dad, poor dad thing and reminded myself assets, liabilities, and convinced myself that real estate was the answer. But at that time, I was like, okay, let's just buy a duplex, start from there. And then, you know, listening to Bigger Pockets, like everybody else at that time, I was like, what's my freedom number? I need to buy 50 duplexes or whatever it is in order to replace my income. And that sounds realistic for like a little bit until it's not. And the light bulb goes off. And then you're like, this isn't sustainable. But I did buy that first duplex in 2014. My wife and I were living in Washington, D.C. at the time, which I'm sure you and everybody else knows is prohibitively expensive. But I was intent on buying at least a duplex, not a single family home, just to kind of offset some of that risk, right? If you have a single family home, it's either 100% occupied or 100% vacant. There is no in between. So that's why I really got attracted to the small multifamily. So we bought a duplex in Richmond, Virginia for, I think, $85,000, put about $25,000 down because they required like, you know, 25% down payment and with everything else all into it. And it was fine. It wasn't great. Learned some hard lessons on good property management or bad property management, depending on how you want to take the lesson, and getting inherited tenants, which I wound up having to evict. So a lot of lessons learned on that first property, but that's how I really got started in real estate in general.
Got it. I want to kind of dig into some of your kind of aggressive paying down of student debt and then, you know, peel back the onion a bit more on kind of the real estate space, because our stories are similar in the sense that we both started with a duplex and we have a similar philosophy on risk and spreading it amongst multiple units. But before we jump into a further conversation, we'll take a quick sponsor break and we'll be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
We are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. We've got Tim Little, and we were talking about kind of your initial journey through the military. And then obviously, as you kind of started to get involved in real estate, you started like I did with a duplex. I totally agree. I thought that single family houses were too risky for my taste. I didn't like having one tenant, one unit. And so we bought a duplex and, you know, we actually inherited a tenant, which she was good. And then we had to fill the other unit. And that tenant was actually worse. So sometimes inheriting tenants is not terrible.
Yeah.
But I guess talk about the beginning when you kind of were paying down debt. And it sounds like you were doing that pretty aggressively. It sounds like that was kind of your ability to get that weight off of your shoulders. So you felt maybe more comfortable getting into the investing space, knowing that you had kind of your debts cleared. Is that fair? Or maybe talk through that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I came out of grad school, it was pretty shocking to me. And of course, I should have been paying attention to this stuff anyways, but I kind of ignored it for a bit. But I came out of grad school with a total of about $130,000 in school debt. And I was just like, okay, that's fine. So I committed, you know, between me and my wife, she's very much of the same mindset of living below our means, not getting caught up in the keeping up with the Joneses, which is very easy to do when you're in your early 30s, living in a place like DC, but we lived well below our means. We bought a house that was less than we could afford in an up and coming neighborhood. And so instead of putting the minimum down on those loans, which I think was maybe like $1,200, I was able to put like $1,500 a month towards those loans, sometimes more. And so I brought it from $130,000 down to like $85,000 within the course of like 4 years that we were living in DC. And then when we sold our house in Washington, DC, our residence, we wound up making a little over $85,000 on it. And so, you know, we looked at each other and we're like, well, yeah, we could use this for the down payment on our next house, which was in Tampa, or we could use it to pay off those school loans and just have that black cloud lifted completely. And so that's what we decided to do. I literally wrote a check for, I don't know, $83,000 and change to completely clear out my school loans. And besides the psychological effect it has, you know, taking that weight off the shoulders, like you said, it also puts you in a much better position to feel like you can start investing more aggressively.
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple schools of thought, right, when it comes to paying off debt. And, you know, there's always this good debt versus bad debt and, you know, high interest rate debt versus low. And I'm assuming your student loans were like mine that were fairly low interest rates. And so other people would maybe think of, instead of paying the debt down, invest that money and then use that money, you know, the residuals to pay the debt or you pay off the debt. So I'm of the mindset that, like you are, I would rather get that off my books, knowing that maybe is it the right financial decision, like numbers wise, maybe not, but from a risk and a comfortability perspective, it makes your life a whole lot easier to not have that constant payment of $1,000, $2,000 a month, which is a lot of money to kind of be shelling out knowing that you're paying some of that in interest. So you've got the debt paid off and then you moved to Tampa. So how did that happen? And then at what point did you kind of really start doing more in the real estate world? Because obviously you started with the duplex, but how did you kind of move into anything else?
Yeah. And so as you start looking into the investing in general, you start to get exposed to different asset types and stuff like that. And so at some point along that road, I got introduced to syndications. You know, fast forward a little bit, like you said, we left DC and came to Tampa. And that was because I had the opportunity to go on military orders again. So as a reservist, you can like hop on active duty orders for like a year at a time or 2 years at a time. And I was like, well, here's an opportunity for someone to pay to move me and my family to Tampa. And, you know, we had had enough of DC after 4 years. Our first daughter had just been born. Right. So we had to consider that aspect as well. So they moved us to Tampa. I started work there. And then I started seeing more stuff about syndications, right? And so I started listening to podcasts, you know, just like this one to learn more about it. But eventually I just wound up going to a convention. Just really drank from the fire hose because it was just a weekend of straight syndication education. Yeah. And if you go in not knowing a whole lot, it's a lot to take in, especially when they're going into the legal aspect, underwriting, all this stuff. And I was just like, my head was blown back, but I felt like I understood enough to know that it was a good opportunity. And of course, they tried to pitch me, you know, the $25,000 program, yada, yada. And right. I was like, listen, like at that time, I knew I was about to deploy again. And so I was going to be gone for a year and I wouldn't be able to use any coaching. So I was like, there's no point in me doing that. But what I will do is start to talk to some sponsors, syndicators, whatever you wanted to call them, and try to find one that I trust. And that's exactly what I did. So instead of putting that $25,000 that I had, which was a lot of money to me in terms of capital to deploy, instead of putting it towards a coaching program, I was like, let me invest this money and kind of learn while I earn is what I call it. Because like I said, I was going to be sitting in Kuwait or Baghdad for the next 9 months anyways. So it gave me the opportunity to ask all the questions that I had, really learn from the passive investor's perspective what this process looks like, and then just get a better understanding of the whole flow of things. And it worked, right? Like, I forget when I got my first distribution check, but when I did, I was like, okay, this is a real thing. This is the proof of concept that I needed, that this property was real, this syndicator was real, and that my money was being put towards the things that he said it was, and that's paying off.
Yeah. So a couple of things there that I want to dig into, because I think it's really important, especially because we're recording this on January 2nd, 2024. And so we are still in this weird multifamily time when if you bought a deal in 2021, 2022 in a variable rate debt with a rate cap or without, you're likely not in a massively strong position, right? And there's been a lot of news about different big syndicators foreclosing on deals, et cetera, et cetera. So at what point did you start your syndication journey? And then as you're thinking about that, how did you get to the point where you felt you knew enough, obviously, about syndications? You went to that conference, but then to passively invest in real estate. That's one of the ways that we started as well, my wife and I. That's the way a lot of people start, or they only passively invest because maybe they've got a great job or a career that they love and they don't have the time or interest to really learn enough about syndication to do it full-time themselves, right? So when did you start? And then, you know, how did you get to that comfortability point with that syndicator to be like, hey, here's 25 grand that I worked very hard for, and you take it and go hopefully bring it back with friends?
Yeah. And so this was 2017. That's when I went to that first convention. So like I said, I continued to educate myself, started talking to sponsors. And it was in like late 2017 that I actually passively invested that first time. Because I thought I was asking all the right questions. In retrospect, I wasn't. I was probably asking a lot of dumb questions, but that's okay. And luckily, it wound up working out, right? That deal got pretty much exactly the returns that they said they would. It didn't blow it out of the water like the anomaly that was COVID time period. And we could talk about that, but it was as promised. And so I was very happy with that. And it wasn't until 2019 when I did my first deal that I got on as a general partner. Okay. And that happened also as a result of going to one of these conferences where I was meeting up with other, you know, like-minded folks who want to be more active on the, you know, general partner side of things.
Yeah.
And they had a deal that they were interested in that was right in my backyard in Tampa, not literally in my backyard, but, you know, in my neighborhood. And they asked me if I wanted to be a limited partner on it. And I did have some capital saved up from my deployment, but I was like, no, man, I want to be a general partner. I want to find my own deal. Everybody's hyped up. You know, they want to do their own thing. But, you know, you quickly learn that this is a team sport and it's really hard to do your own thing. And they came back a little bit later, I'd say probably a few months later, right when they were on the cusp of closing on this deal, but they weren't quite there yet. Okay. They needed some extra help, both from a capital perspective and from a general partner perspective, which I could provide because, again, I was boots on the ground.
Yep.
And so they were willing to bring me in as a general partner for that one. Pretty small slice, but I was okay with that because it was an opportunity to get that experience in the deal, get that general partnership status. And so that's where I started off on the more active side of real estate investing.
Got it. And the part, so that was 2019. So you kind of got it right before COVID. And then obviously it probably ran up and you probably sold it, made millions in 2021 when everybody else was, you know, clamoring to get a deal. So timing really, you know, was great on that one. And I guess what was the kind of profile of that deal? What class was it? How big was it? Obviously, we know it was in Tampa. And was it the traditional syndication value add kind of strategy?
So I'd say yes and no. It was unique in a couple of perspectives. One is that it was a portfolio deal. So it was 59 units and it was multiple buildings, right? The largest of which I think was 23 units. Okay. So it was a little messy from that perspective, like a legal perspective and getting the paperwork done, but we were able to make it happen. I think it just took longer than it would on a more traditional deal. It was a class, I'll call it C. It was a good hard C because it was in North Tampa, which is lower income or working class. But it was your traditional value add in the respect that it was outdated both on the exterior and the interior. So we added a couple of amenities, started off with painting to make it look fresh, and then started renovating interiors of units as folks moved out and increased rents as time went on. And it was kind of a textbook from that perspective. Again, like you said, with the timing, you know, rents went up way past what I think we projected because it went into COVID and that's when we wound up selling. But otherwise, it was pretty textbook as a value add, classy deal. The only unique aspect was really the portfolio aspect, which we tried to combine some lots and stuff like that to make it a little less messy on sale for the next guy. But still, it wasn't one building, so it's a little different.
Yeah, got it. Well, that was 2019. Obviously, we're 2024 now. So talk us through kind of the last few years of, you know, have you been more active, less active? Like, what's that look like?
Yeah. And so it's turned into really like a couple of deals a year. What we've focused on, like me and the folks that I partnered with, is we try to partner with other operators who maybe they found the deal, but they need extra help from both, again, the capital and the asset management side of things, which is where we come in. So, you know, I'm in the asset management meetings with property managers multiple times per week with all these different properties that we have. So, you know, now it's a relatively large portfolio, mostly focused on, I think the first one after that was Tallahassee. But then we have three properties in Atlanta. And then our most recent one was in South Dakota, but that was out of our normal Sun Belt region. Yeah. But I think that's what we need to do now anyways, is start looking outside into different regions to find, you know, where the fundamentals are still strong. Because some areas that were super strong during the COVID time, as you know, are starting to weaken a little bit. It's a correction in most places. Some places it's more dramatic than others, but like, you know, even Atlanta and Dallas, places like that, that went like gangbusters for a little while, are just starting to slow down. So now we're looking for where the more significant growth and demand is in other areas, like I said, in South Dakota, where you wouldn't necessarily think of.
Yeah, no, I definitely have never looked at a deal in South Dakota, that's for sure. I guess when you think about your sweet spot when it comes to the type of role you like to play on a general partnership team, obviously, as you well know, going through, you know, your own syndications and going through that coaching and conference stuff, like there's a ton of different roles. Like it takes a village to take one of these things down, to your point earlier. And so I guess, you know, where have you kind of landed? Like, here's what I like to bring to the table when it comes to a multifamily deal or group syndication.
Yeah. And so for me, leaning back on my military experience, you know, one thing that I think I'm pretty good at is one, solving problems, and two, managing teams. So it really is that asset management side of things, to where I can be involved, help come up with creative solutions to the problems that we're facing, and make sure that the team on the ground, the property management team, is executing, you know, in a timely and efficient manner. Because sometimes you have some property managers who are self-sufficient, right? They do the thing when they're supposed to do it. Other ones, it takes a little more hand-holding, and maybe they're not as creative when it comes to thinking of solutions to the problems they're facing because they have a big portfolio, or maybe they just don't care. You know, you don't know what the reasons are, but that's what I'm finding, because a lot of sponsors, especially ones that maybe like grew too big too fast, they're stretched a little thin. Yeah. With the properties that they have. So someone like me, who can focus on it more than maybe they have the bandwidth to do so, can catch the problems that they may not have caught, because I'm also in those meetings and I'm, you know, providing solutions, et cetera.
Yeah, I think one thing that's very apparent going through the last few years of, you know, getting into deals in 2020 and 2021 and being like, these are great. And then realizing a couple of years later, things are not as rosy when interest rates double and insurance doubles and, you know, all your expenses go up and all that fun stuff. So some of it was market driven that was outside of our control. But the big thing that you can control is your asset management, right? And I think, you know, having on-site property managers is required at properties of the scale that we go after, 100 plus units, et cetera. But at the end of the day, they are not invested typically in the deal. They are employees of the business that operates the deal. And so as an asset manager, talk a little bit more about kind of what your role is for people that maybe don't know the difference exactly of an asset manager versus a property manager, because they are very different. And obviously one is incentivized to have the property go well because they're an investor in that property. So maybe talk a little more about kind of some of the high level nuts and bolts, if you will, of a proper asset manager.
I guess the way that I try to relate it to most people in a framework that they understand is like project management, right? A lot of folks who are in business understand what project management is. Here is the business plan. Here is the time that we have to do it. Here are the individuals who are handling each item. And that's kind of what we do as asset managers. You know, we're sitting on these meetings and we have a business plan for each property that we have. And that business plan may be renovate 50% of the units within 5 years. Whatever that is, you have to stay on a certain timeline in order to get that done. And then, of course, there's budget. You want to be staying on budget. Otherwise, it can quickly grow out of control if left unattended. Even small stuff that you wouldn't even think about, like the expenses that the property manager has, like, oh, here's some random expense for travel and stuff like this. If you're not looking at those line items, stuff will sneak in there and that'll slowly start to build up, even drilling down into work orders, right? If you're looking at the trends and if you had 20 work orders and 15 were completed, this is pretty good. But if you see that work order number start to creep up, you know, it's 20 last week, now it's 30, now it's 40, and you could see that they're just getting behind. Well, those work orders are real issues for tenants, yep. Whether it's heat, leaky faucets, whatever. And you have to understand the secondary and tertiary effects of that, right? It's not just someone having a leaky faucet that hasn't gotten fixed for 3 months. Well, now they're getting pissed off. Now they're leaving a one-star review for your property, which goes to reputation management. And now it's harder to lease up because you're seeing your score drop on apartments.com. So being able to drill down on all these different things and understanding that they all have, like, you know, repercussions if not addressed.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I notice is really important. And, you know, some of the good deals kind of fell off is just because the asset management wasn't as strong as necessary, right? And, you know, some people were buying deals, you know, in 2021, 2022, to your point, grew a little too fast, got too many deals and weren't able to actually manage everything. And so that's one of the things that, you know, as I continue to look at operators that I partner with, whether it's passively investing or helping them raise capital and do investor relations and all of that, is really what is their asset management structure? Are they using a third party, which some people do? Is it vertically integrated into their business? Because I would prefer it vertically integrated because then they're very much incentivized to have a healthy outcome. So I guess over the last few years now, you've done a bunch of deals. What does your portfolio look like right now? And then, you know, as we start 2024, what is your mindset or kind of appetite for deals? Are you still hunting? What does that look like for you?
Yeah. And so portfolio is a little over 600, about 90 million in worth. I try not to get too focused on the vanity metrics, as we call them. But to your point, I think what I've told my investors in the New Year's email that I just sent out is that my focus will be on consolidating what we already have and ensuring the health of the current inventory. But that being said, if a great deal comes along or if great partners come along with the deal, we're not going to turn it down. But I don't think we're as focused on growth as we were in the past, right? Right now, with all the headwinds that we're facing, because for all the reasons you've already mentioned, we need to focus on the stability and growth of our current portfolio rather than necessarily growing the number of units within our portfolio. So probably instead of two or three deals, it may only be one. And that's in part because it's become much harder to underwrite deals that make sense or find deals that make sense through our underwriting because prices are higher, interest rates are higher, et cetera. But also because we don't want to get stretched too thin either. And we want to make sure that we have all our current assets stabilized, safe, and growing before we start to turn our attention to other things.
Yeah. Yeah. I think right now is kind of a let the powder dry on the sidelines. Let's get it, keep it ready because there could be that deal that an operator is distressed. Maybe the property is fine, but the operator is stretched. Maybe they're undercapitalized. Their rate cap's about to expire. Their variable rate debt's about to expire and the bank is not, or their lender is not being flexible. So I think there could be pockets of interesting deals. But I think to your point, making sure that your current house is stable versus going out and trying to build a new one makes a lot of sense. I'm curious about kind of the change in your philosophy, if at any, around where you're looking. It sounds like that has changed a little bit. You're going outside of the core markets of, you know, Florida, Georgia, and Texas, I think you mentioned, as far as like your current portfolio, going into like a South Dakota, which I find interesting. But have you shifted your focus around the asset class or how you structure the deals? Because I've been talking to a lot of people that are, you know, essentially saying adios to variable rate debt. They're going fixed rate, even if it is a bridge. They're just saying, I don't want to run the risk, et cetera. So maybe talk through your changes in your structure or philosophy around the deals that you think are interesting going into 24.
Yeah, and I think it's probably yes on all counts, not because there was anything flawed at the time with how we were doing things, but as the circumstances change, you just have to pivot. The South Dakota, for example, the reason that's a good market is because of lack of supply. And so, you know, we bought a property that's had 100% occupancy for several months, but we also got a very competitive price because it was sold by the ones who built it. And they had intended to hold on to it, but had a family situation. So you have this exceptional scenario where you have this asset that is keeping 100% occupancy and still growing rents, and you got a good price on it. Now, on our core areas where places like Atlanta, for example, I think what will change there is the asset class. We've dealt with some Class C, and whereas that may have been fine in some places, in Atlanta specifically, the challenges that we face with putting out delinquent tenants has just been so painful that it's dissuading us from having to deal with that again. Otherwise, all the fundamentals, I think, in Atlanta are great, growing jobs, you know, growing economy, et cetera. But if you have this one thing that, you know, hurts you, like you can't get out non-paying tenants to put in paying tenants, then that makes it very challenging. So what we could do is move up to the Class B or Class A, and then you're not facing that same challenge, at least not to the same extent in that area. And then in terms of, you know, financing and stuff like that, you know, one of our recent deals, we took over a loan assumption because that made sense, right? Especially in this current environment, if you're able to do a loan assumption at, you know, less than 4% and the deals make sense otherwise, all things being equal, well, right, then that's a great deal. So as we're underwriting and we're looking at deals, you know, whether they're coming from brokers, this and that, one of the things, you know, that I tend to key on is, oh, there's an assumable mortgage that piques my interest. Now, it still has to make sense, you know, every other way, but it gets around the current issue, which is the high interest rates.
And you're locked into a low fixed rate, right? So you know at maximum what your debt service is going to be, right? So you don't have the worry about, oh, is the Fed going to raise? Or are they going to drop? Like, you know, what does it look like? So you're like, I know what my debt service is. I can pay the debt. So I'm not going to lose this property, assuming that, you know, everything else kind of stays stable. So as a military veteran, I guess, well, first question, are you kind of in real estate full-time now? That's your full-time gig, or it sounds like you're still in the reserve, so you do that, you know, kind of part-time, if you will. So I guess, is real estate your full-time gig? And I guess, what's that look like?
Yeah, so it has been for the past a little over 2 years, because I came off orders about 2 years ago, and that's so that I could take command on the reserve side. Yeah. You know, the 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year thing. Now that I've gotten out of command, I'm actually about to go back on orders over in Tampa, where I live. So not like I'll have a big commute or anything. So I am going to have to adjust how I do things. I still plan on staying just as involved on the deals that, you know, I'm currently own. It'll just be a little bit more of a time management challenge than what I've had before, where I was doing it full time throughout the day.
Yeah, no. Time management will become a big piece when you're trying to do both of those things, I imagine. Have you seen any, or you kind of worked on anything to help kind of military veterans like coming out like you did and saying, hey, real estate's kind of a option. If you go on orders and you get some money instead of buying that, you know, brand new car or whatever, there's options to invest. Like, has that been something that you and your business has kind of established or helped support those folks?
Yeah, and a lot of it is just through education, right? Because a lot of people just don't know that passive investing is an option. So, you know, one of the things that I tell them is you might have more money than you think, because I had a old 401k floating around, right? And so I rolled that over into a solo 401k, which I was able to use to passively invest in real estate deals. And a lot of folks in the military, especially if they're retired, they might have that TSP, which is, you know, our equivalent of a 401k, sitting on the sidelines. And, you know, maybe they've moved on to a new company and they didn't roll it over because they have a 401k at their new company. That TSP may be sitting there with $50,000 or $100,000 in it, not really doing anything. And they're not really managing it. And they don't know that they can kind of take control of their own retirement funds. And so that's been a big aspect of the education, is helping them figure out that one step. The other piece is trying to get them out of the mindset that, you know, they have to do the single family route that so many of us start out with. Yeah. Because a lot of times, full-time military, they're moving place to place every 3 years, let's just say. Okay. But a lot of them are smart enough to hold on to that house that they had and rent it out. Now, it wasn't an intentional investment necessarily, so maybe it's not getting, you know, great returns, but they think it's still a good investment. And it is better than nothing. But when they see the time that they're putting into it, you know, how little actual return they're getting out of it, I would argue that in many instances, it makes sense to put that money into passive investing, you know, liquidate those assets, roll it into passive investing, and then we can still get you a tax break, you know, from accelerated depreciation or whatever. That way they can actually be passive and have that money still working, growing for them, getting the same tax benefits that they thought they needed single family to get, essentially getting all the benefits without all the landlord headaches that they've had with these, you know, two or three or sometimes even four single family properties that they've collected over the years.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, to your point, some investing is better than none, but I think you're right. The duplex that we still own, we bought it in 2019. Some years are great. Some years, like, we had to just put some money in to renovate one of the units. So a lot of our cash flow went out the window, right? So it's like, sometimes being passive is great because then you don't have to worry about the headaches, the tenants, trash, all that fun stuff. So that's awesome that you're helping the military veteran community kind of with that education so that if they choose to, you know, use that as an option, it's great that you're doing that. So I want to kind of transition us to kind of the final three questions that I ask every guest. So we'll start off with question one. What is one piece of advice that you started or helped you along your real estate investing journey?
One piece of advice. I mean, I guess as cheesy as it sounds, the whole rich dad, poor dad thing, like, because I didn't get any financial education, even in undergrad, it broke it down in terms that were plain enough for me to understand it, like this good, this bad. Make your money work harder for you, right? Don't let your money be lazy, I guess is the advice. And that's what I try to put out. You know, your money should always be working for you, because if not, you know, sometimes more than others, you know, it's going to just be losing its value sitting around.
Yeah, no, Rich Dad Poor Dad was the light bulb book that I read. My wife and I started in this thing. So I totally appreciate that for sure. And that kind of leads me to my next question. What is your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
Ooh, right now. I think one of the ones that I was reading that was, I think, was the most interesting was Influence. I think it's Cialdini, Dr. Cialdini. Yeah. So it just goes into like the human psychology of selling, buying. And I've always found like behavioral economics in general very interesting. So being able to understand that both for my own benefit, so I don't succumb to, you know, some scam or something like that, so that I can use it to help more effectively communicate with others on the opportunities that I have. I think it's a really good read, listen, however you take your books.
I've listened to it. I actually own it on my bookshelf. That's what I was looking at over there. So yeah, no, it's a good one. All right, last question. If you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you could live an amazing life just off of the passive income from your investments, what would you do?
I want to be clear, right? Like, I don't always want to be an active investor, and I don't want to have to convince everyone else to be an active investor. If I could, my goal would be to have enough money to passively invest. Yeah. And what I would do with that is what I'm trying to do to a much smaller extent now, which is take my family places, show them new things, new experiences, because I'm an avid traveler and so is my wife. And so we want to raise our daughters in that same environment. You know, we didn't get started too early because they were too young. We want them to be old enough to remember. Otherwise, I feel like it's a waste. But for spring break this year, we're going on our first international trip together to Germany. Already bought the tickets. And I just feel like that's a good segue into international travel. And, you know, we'll go from there. Maybe we'll go to Cambodia in a year or two after that, because that's where my wife's family is from. So okay. They could see all these different aspects of cultures, people, language, because I think it just provides such a valuable perspective.
No, I totally agree. And yeah, travel is definitely high on my list. We're actually planning a trip to London and Italy for April. So we'll be heading out there. So this has been awesome. If people want to learn more about you, your business, maybe some of the deals that you're looking at in South Dakota, any of that stuff, how should people reach you? What's the best way to get you?
Sure. So they can always get me at tim@zanainvestments.com, if you can see behind me here. But I'm also pretty active on LinkedIn. So please reach out, connect with me there. If you guys are into podcasts, I also host a podcast called Journey to Multifamily Millions that you might like. Otherwise, yeah, I try to make myself pretty available.
Awesome. This has been great, Tim. I really appreciate the time. And yeah, hopefully 2024 starts off as well as possible. And you have a great year.
All right. You too. Appreciate it.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way, you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.